choreographer who created it.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Wait a minute, do cats drink coffee?
Perhaps a demi-tasse after Swan Lake?
So not too often.
Correct.
And Cat Radio Cafe, you can expect to hear that program today, or tonight, I should say, at 9 p.m. But first, stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion. If you want to get appointed to a position in the U.S. government, what are you not allowed to say about climate change? What are you not allowed to say if you're nominated to a government position in the United States in 2022? Check out this quote and see if it sounds radical to you. Quote, U.S. regulators can and should be looking at their existing powers and considering how they might be brought to bear on efforts to mitigate climate risk. Unquote. That was Sarah Bloom Raskin writing an opinion piece last year, 2021. Now, this year, 2022, President Biden nominates her to a senior position at the Federal Reserve for banking regulation. Her title would have been vice chair for supervision. And her view, according to these two lines in this opinion piece, is that the government should consider how they can mitigate climate risk. That's all she says. Government should consider how they can mitigate climate risk. No specific proposal, no specific regulation, nothing about how much or with what measures, not calling for anything in particular at all. And every Republican boycotted her nomination. Biden was still urging the Senate to confirm her, but then guess who said no? Joe Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who owns a coal business, personally profits from fossil fuels, said her views on climate were unacceptable and he would oppose her nomination. So with Manchin plus Republican opposition, the White House figures she can't get confirmed. It'll be at least 51 votes against her and they withdraw her. No government post for someone who wants, quote, mitigate climate risk, unquote. That's all she wants to do. Elizabeth Warren, senator from Massachusetts, explained it like this, quote, the lobbyists have power on Capitol Hill, and when they see their power threatened, they fight back hard. Sarah Bloom Raskin is just the latest casualty, unquote. Now, of course, that's true, and that might explain Republican opposition. But we don't even need lobbyists to explain Joe Manchin's view. He personally loses money when we do climate regulation.
No, he doesn't. Now, what Manchin said about Sarah Bloom Raskin, quoted in the New York Times, was, quote, her previous public statements have failed to satisfactorily address my concerns about the critical importance of financing and all of the above energy policy to meet our nation's critical energy needs. I have come to the conclusion that I am unable to support her nomination to serve as a member of the Federal Reserve Board. The Federal Reserve Board must remain hyper-focused on ending the inflation taxes hurting working families and getting more workers off the sidelines and back into the economy, unquote. He does not care about working families. We're getting more workers off the sidelines or back and back into the economy. Yes. So anyway, Senator Manchin saying we must have all of the above energy strategy. That's his exact words, by which he means burn more coal. Don't exclude any energy source. Burn coal, burn more coal. Put more money in my account. Federal Reserve, go focus on something else. Don't think about climate. I'm going to oppose nominees who think that climate has any part of their job. That's Joe Manchin's position. That's the 1% position. Of course, if Raskin had been confirmed and taken up a seat on that board, nothing much would have changed. Let's be honest. Maximum, you get a tweak to a regulatory framework incentivizing some subsector of something to be more energy efficient. She doesn't have power to reduce emissions or to shut down power plants or to prohibit fossil fuel infrastructure, let alone something that would get bigger progress like rationing fossil fuels. She's not even advocating for gumming up the works, right? In fact, Sarah Bloom Raskin was already on that federal board during the Obama administration, which did not much. She was a Federal Reserve governor. Biden is nominating her back to the Federal Reserve Board with a different title. She's already been there with a track record that doesn't exactly include radical change. So this was not someone who is going to come in and wreck the fossil fuel industry. She poses no threat to Joe Manchin's coal business, let alone to BP or Chevron or ExxonMobil. This statement by Manchin was sending a message. Don't even think about it. Not even a person who thinks that it can about it can get in. That's what he's saying. We will not entertain anybody who entertains the possibility that we are facing a climate crisis. If I had read this piece by Raskin before all this, one where she says it's worth considering climate, I would have glossed right over it, turned the page, found it utterly unremarkable. It's not something I would have even made a note of. People, mainstream, not particularly liberal or leftist people, were saying this decades ago, that we should use regulation to mitigate climate risk. There's nothing radical about this whatsoever, which is why we're in the position we're in. Even thinking Republicans are saying this now, the National Review says it. Conservative newspaper editorial boards say it. But Joe Manchin doesn't want to allow it, not in a nominee to the United States Federal Reserve. It's a type of censorship. Yes, but it's censorship. Joe Manchin thinks we just can't be having a vice chair for supervision thinking about the possibility of regulating climate. And as a result, no such person can get confirmed by the United States Senate. So this is where we are in Manchin hell.
In terms of political strategy reacting to this information, there are some people who might see this and think, well, okay, that sucks, but that's just the reality. Joe Manchin won't let anyone in who thinks this. So I guess the right thing to do is to find someone who is the furthest toward climate regulation that Manchin will allow, and it's not Raskin, so move to the right of Raskin. There might be people who think this, even though Raskin, former Federal Reserve governor, is already very far to the right of what's necessary. These very centrist Biden nominees become like our allies, apparently, and maybe it migrates well into right of center territory on the issue of climate just to get someone confirmed, which is presumably what Manchin wants, right? But I think that's a trap. Extinction Rebellion has the right idea with the first demand, which is tell the truth. If it's not corresponding to the truth, don't go supporting it. So we probably aren't going to have a rally supporting Sarah Bloom Raskin. Extinction Rebellion doesn't normally get into political appointees anyway, but even just being observers here about the political situation, Raskin is so mild that she's already not corresponding to the truth. You can't read any serious climate science and think that what she said is reasonable. We are miles beyond the point of needing to consider climate regulation. We're in an international emergency facing the serious possibility of a mostly uninhabitable planet. The way to get movement is not to move to them, to move to the rightist position, to try to get the thing that will satisfy Joe Manchin as long as it's left of Dick Cheney. No, we must tell the truth. The truth is that no one whose views resemble a scientifically informed viewpoint on climate can even get appointed to a senior government position. When that's the reality, it's hard to see the U.S. government coming to our rescue. So what does it take? What can we do? When you see it this way, maybe it's not so surprising that folks are out getting arrested in the streets.
And they will continue to get arrested in the streets. You know, there are people saying climate activism should move to the right. One of those people seems to be Matthew Iglesias. About 2 months ago, Iglesias published an article slamming climate activism. It's on his website, which I am not making this up. It's called Slow Boring. That's the name he picked for his website, slowboring.com. All right. Now, he's talking mainly about Sunrise. He doesn't mention Extinction Rebellion, but the article is not friendly to climate activism. So what is he up to here? Matthew Iglesias, if you don't know who he is, he's a journalist, generally thought of as a liberal. He co-founded Vox. He's one of these people who has been successful in making his way around New York, publishing circles and getting interviewed a lot. And gets published in all the news magazines that you have to have connections to get published in. Now, he's made his career on clickbait, and he continues to do that, right? It's hard to fault him for it since we all click on clickbait, but it's easy to fault him for faulting other people who are trying to save the world from cataclysmic destruction.
Uh-huh.
That is what climate... I mean, let's just put it, let's be blunt about that, right? That is what climate activists like Sunrise and yours truly are trying and thus far failing to accomplish. You might ask, what does Iglesias get out of criticizing them? My goodness. The article is clickbait. It's called Climate Politics for the Real World. And as soon as you hear real world, you know you're getting ready to listen to some ideology. Now, it has the following inflammatory sentence, quote, many millions of dollars have been invested over the years in this style of activism. And if all that money had been piled up and set on fire, we'd be in a better place today, unquote. Well, that sentence comes in the middle without any connection to what comes before or after it. But it makes a good tweet, doesn't it? It riles people up and doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So it's perfect for Twitter and starting a big argument on Twitter. Can definitely get you your next magazine article published. You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. And we've been talking about recent climate crisis news, including what you can't say about climate and still get confirmed to a U.S. government position. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. Now, unfortunate imagery, by the way, in the context of talking about climate, setting things on fire, right? Setting things on fire is, in fact, not putting us in a better place. That's not the essence of his point, but he could have come up with a less insensitive image.
A less insensitive image might have been possible. But to the substance, Iglesias doesn't have a clear argument in this article. Take a look yourself and find me the clear sentence where he specifies the mistakes the climate activists are making. Or, I think too much to ask for and, find the sentence where he says what climate activists should be doing instead of what they're doing now. Neither of those things are there in the article. He seems to think that pushing for climate action is electorally disadvantageous for Democrats, and that means it's bad to do. He expresses a blind faith that Democrats want climate action despite never doing any. Any. Find me one single bill that has passed that actually reduced emissions. Seeing none, what's he defending? The argument left implicit, but we're trying to be charitable here in finding an argument, figure out what he means. The argument seems to be that building mass support for climate action is a waste of time, and we should focus on winning elections for Democrats instead, since Iglesias believes Democratic Party elites are modestly more in support of climate action than the mass public. But notice the contradiction. If the blockage on bolder climate action is that it's an electoral loser, then building mass support for climate action does actually put us in a better situation. People would be more willing to vote for people who were in support of bold climate action. That would follow from the parts of what he says that most resemble an argument. One possibility is that Iglesias isn't so great at this making arguments thing. More likely, though, is that he's a Democratic Party spokesperson writing whatever aligns with the institutional Democratic Party's interests. And those are always going to be more campaign donations and less protests against them. So if you think of the punchline of this article as the Democratic Party speaking, then it all clicks and then it all makes sense. Democratic Party says, please don't ask us to cut emissions. That's just too much for us. Come work on our campaigns instead.
That's a DNC campaign contribution letter. by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly. P.S. He refers to those, quote, many millions of dollars invested, unquote, in climate activism. Well, I wouldn't mind seeing a few nickels of that many million dollars that have supposedly been invested in us, Elise.
I know.
Because I haven't seen one yet. Not one nickel. Nada.
Not a penny.
We are volunteers here at Extinction Rebellion Radio. If there's millions of dollars for us, let me know.
I could use a just even more, just $100,000 would be good.
A few nickels.
All right. Well, interestingly, not every last Republican in the country thinks we have to maximize fossil fuel burning. There's five of them. The Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, wants to promote electric vehicle production in his state. Oh, that sounds very California. There's an electric car plant planned for Rutledge, Georgia, and he's subsidizing it. But Governor Kemp is getting primaried. Donald Trump wants him out, largely, it seems, because of the 2020 election dispute. He still thinks he won. And it seems like a lot of people in the community don't want the factory there in Rutledge, or perhaps it's that there are some organizers coming in who have ties to the fossil fuel industry drumming up opposition. I don't know whether that's the case or not, but there's some level of community opposition. Maybe that's who Iglesias is really talking about, the millions of dollars spent on climate activists or fossil fuel activists on the right. I don't know. And while electric vehicles are not the panacea to the world's climate problems, they are better than the internal combustion engines of the old cars. So it's worth noticing the situation here. Car production is getting a groundswell of conservative opposition. Weird to say, but it's true. Conservatives are opposing car production. Try going to those towns that used to have General Motors plants, where the GM plants are now shut down, and tell them that a community is opposing a car plant and see what reaction you get. Go to Janesville, Wisconsin, or for that matter, Detroit, and let the residents know that the good people of Rutledge, Georgia are mobilizing against a new car plant. Now they look at you stupefied. They'd be uncomprehending. That plant was the gateway to prosperity for them. Now it's gone.
So we have conservatives wrapping themselves in the American flag, opposing car production. Talk about a switch. Car production used to be the essence of Americana. And now the rock-ribbed Republicans are saying no to car production as long as it's electric cars. Would Rutledge, Georgia have a problem with it if it were an internal combustion engine plant, like those old GM plants from places like Janesville? We don't know. That situation isn't happening, so we can't observe it. But you have to wonder, is it that they don't want a plant or they don't want an electric car plant? Was it cars all along, or was it oil? Was it specifically engines that burned oil that were the symbol of Americana? Until fairly recently, we never had the choice. All cars burned oil. Now we have cars that burn oil and cars that don't burn oil, trucks that burn oil and trucks that don't burn oil. So the distinction is emerging. And which one are conservatives going for? Which one has that cultural symbolism? That's more complicated than just saying conservatives don't like electric cars. Some of them do. Republicans buy Teslas. I know some conservatives who buy Teslas. Elon Musk describes himself as a conservative. He seems to be libertarian, and he owns the leading electric car manufacturer. Got to be the richest man in the world by manufacturing electric cars. And the right is cheering him on as he buys Twitter. But looking at this situation in Georgia, at a minimum, what we can say is what's at stake now is whether electric cars can get built in Georgia or not. That's what we're going to find out based on the outcome of this situation.
On the same theme of what conservatives are thinking, the National Policy Director for the American Conservative Coalition is calling for a bold, massive development of clean energy. Now, this is great. This is like a good news segment, right? We've been bombing you with some hard news. We're going to give you a good news segment. His angle is anti-dependence on China. Not anti-China per se, just saying the U.S. should not be in a position of depending on Chinese imports for energy. Yeah, I guess in principle, that's right. Transporting energy materials across the Pacific Ocean isn't the greenest thing to do in the world. Now, his name is Christopher Barnard, by the way, this policy, a national policy director for the American Conservative Coalition. And the article in the National Review is called "Don't Let China Control Our Energy Future." He hits the China dependence point harder than I think is necessary. And true, his definition of clean energy includes natural gas, and mine definitely does not. But he specifically mentions more wind power and more electric vehicles. Yay. And listen to this quote. Quote, "Governments and private businesses around the world are investing unprecedented resources into new innovative forms of technology to tackle global warming, from renewables and battery storage to advanced nuclear energy and hydrogen fuel. The transition to clean energy is shifting economic and geopolitical priorities. Clean energy is the oil of the future. The U.S. should seize this opportunity with both hands," end quote. Guess what? That's what my daughter says all the time. Guess what, mama? Guess what? We agree. I'm down with every word of that.
Me too.
Nope. Now, here's one more quote. "There is no reason we cannot once again harness the power of American ingenuity to decrease our dependence on the communist regime in China and to power our clean energy future," end quote. Here's that Cold War language. Now, this is coming from an organization that has members who are still climate denialists. For them to come out in favor of a massive investment in clean energy, it really is a real development. It's good news, maybe it's great news. They're publishing this in the highly conservative National Review. So it's reaching an audience that includes climate deniers and people who are deeply politically conservative. So we can trumpet this. Let's sell this when we're finding ourselves in debates with those who disagree with us. To say it once more, the American Conservative Coalition is on record calling for a massive expansion of clean energy.
Woohoo! I actually think it's seriously good. The American Conservative Coalition is saying some of the same things that we are.
I'm suspicious.
Who would have thought it? Also flooding in Australia, in some of the exact same places as flooding from last year. So no, you're not accidentally clicking on something from an episode from May of 2021. This is happening again in May of 2022. 21 dead and thousands of homes left uninhabitable. Seeing the interviews of the people affected, I was dumbstruck. The people were saying that they were surprised. They were angry. How could this happen, they were saying. They were incredulous that the same place flooded again. Have they not been paying attention? How can they be so unaware of what's going on? At least this is what I was thinking as I was reading this coverage. How did they manage to miss that climate change makes more volatile weather? From a person who pays attention to this stuff, you might say, how could they not know this information? But the answer, I think, is we have utterly failed to inform people. We is not just, I mean, it's the news media first and foremost, but it is also climate activism. What we've done hasn't been sufficient. But of course, it's the news media as well. These people are in Australia. Maybe these folks are reading News Corporation sources and watching News Corporation sources. That's Rupert Murdoch's company, the same company that owns Fox. So maybe these folks, are getting climate denialist stuff fed to them all the time. In the interviews, they repeatedly said, "We heard this was a once in a century event. So how can it be happening again?" Well, climate deniers, like the folks at News Corporation and at Fox, are severe offenders. But it is also mainstream media. Even places like the BBC and the ABC, that's Australian Broadcasting Company, that won't always be so clear about what climate change is and what it's doing. Or there might be a clear sentence in the online article, but it's down near the bottom. And there's a lot of mentions of once in a century events that aren't directly and immediately debunked. So you have to read the whole article with attention to get it. And how many people do that with every news article? Reporters can be doing a whole lot better. And that can explain why someone who's just been flooded out is incredulous at the fact that they've been flooded. We still, in fact, have a lot of people making decisions about where to live based on having wrong ideas.
Well, they can, you know, they can cover it like they cover sports. I mean, nothing gets covered better than sports. So why not treat climate change with the same kind of, you know, thoroughness and in-depth reporting?
You are listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Ailee Slane. We've been talking about recent climate crisis news and perspectives. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM. And a thank you is due to our wonderful sound editors, Brandon McMillan and Cheyenne Tang, each of whom has edited multiple episodes since we last had a chance to thank them on the air. Also, congratulations to Cheyenne, who graduated just very recently from Northeastern University in Boston. And instead of taking the day off after her graduation day, she is actually sound editing this very episode. So thank you and congratulations to Cheyenne.
Check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The displaced playwright on Tuesday, May 24th at 9 p.m. will be joined by author and former ballerina Tony Bentley, whose new book, Serenade, a Balanchine story, is a love letter to that particular ballet and to the genius of George Balanchine, the great Russian-born choreographer who created it.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Wait a minute, do cats drink coffee?
Perhaps a demi-tasse after Swan Lake?
So not too often.
Correct.
For WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry, thanking new BAI buddies. Tracy Washington from Somerset, New Jersey. She's a new buddy and hopes WBAI continues and informs the people. Her favorite show is one we just relaunched, Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. It's broadcast on Fridays at 5 p.m.
Welcome to Black Agenda Radio, where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective.
Daniel from Lodi, New Jersey, thank you for becoming a new buddy. He says he likes all BAI shows. Nathaniel from Philly is a new buddy, and so is another buddy from the Village. Gregory from Massapequa says thank you to WBAI. His favorite show is What's Happening with Ralph Pointer and Betty Davis.
Get set, Ralph Pointer, What's Happening?
Good evening, my sisters and brothers, brothers and sisters. We do have an interesting program for you, as we promised.
David Somerville from Harlem is a large WBAI buddy contributor. His favorite show is Living for the City with Michael G. Haskins. He also likes many of our programs. He lists them, The Gary Null Show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from the National Institutes of Health, National Institute on Aging. Lower the risk of dementia in people who are...
Baby,
Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall.
Yes, here on WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. There is so much going on in the world, and it's great to know that WBAI is here for us.
David also likes Black Agenda Radio and Milton Alamadi and Colin Benjamin's Black Star News.
Greetings, greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to your favorite Pan-Africa news show.
From the streets with Bob Law.
Let's look a little closer at the music that in a real sense could be called the soundtrack for the 20th century. It's going to be an interesting conversation. So join me this sunny spring Saturday in the city. This is 99.5 WBAI. I'm Bob Law.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the origins of the war in Ukraine and the role that the United States played in bringing that war about.
Mind Flight with Imhotep Gary Bird.
Well, good evening. Pass the word. We are back with you flying high on a Sunday night. It's Simple Tap Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Mind Flight, your gateway to the Black experience. As you know, Mind Flight is all about the local, national, international stops and the stops of mind, body, and spirit that take us soul traveling wherever the winds of change take
us. Sojourner Truth and with Margaret Prescott. Vantage Point with the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. Paul Fisher's What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Peter Beauchamp's All Mixed Up.
What a beautiful morning. Turn on the radio and let's have some music.
Democracy Now!, which is broadcast weekday mornings at 8 a.m. right after WBAI's new morning program, What's Going On?
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
BAI Buddy Favorites.